From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we compare President George W. Bush with Governor George W. Bush. We talk with journalist Ken Herman of the Austin American-Statesman. He's covered Texas state politics since 1979. Now he's in Washington covering Bush's first 6 months in the White House. Also, America's prison boom, how for-profit prisons and high-tech prisons are changing prison culture and the culture of prison towns. We talk with Wall Street Journal reporter Joseph Hallinan about his new book, Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Poisonville, the new CD by Ronnie Elliott. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Russian officials reacted angrily today to the Bush administration's decision to expel dozens of Russian diplomats. The administration ordered four Russian diplomats to leave the country immediately. Officials said the diplomats were accused of involvement in the case of an FBI agent who's been accused of spying for Russia. Some 46 other Russians were told to be out of the United States by July 1st. The administration says they were being asked to leave because Russia has too many intelligence agents in the United States. Russia's foreign minister said today that the expulsion was a political move. Igor Ivanov said Russia will adequately respond to what he called an unfriendly step by the United States. Secretary of State Colin Powell has protested China's detention of a U.S.-based college professor and her family. The Chinese woman is still being held, although her husband and son have been released and sent back to the United States. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
The woman is sociologist Gao Jian of American University. She, her husband, and five-year-old son were taken into custody February 11th in Beijing. They were held for 26 days, with neither parent able to see the boy, who was an American citizen. Gao Jian is still being held on vague charges of undermining state security. Secretary of State Powell says he has expressed his displeasure to the Chinese government.
We think it is particularly outrageous that the young boy, son, was held away from his parents, away from family members for an extended period of time, and we were not notified in the timely manner that is required and expected.
Secretary Powell says he raised the issue last night with China's visiting Vice Premier Chen Qichen. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
After several delays, a trial has begun for five people accused in the killings of a Guatemalan bishop and human rights advocate 3 years ago. Mike Lanchin reports from Guatemala City.
When the court convened early Thursday for the beginning of this groundbreaking trial, the three military officers accused of the 1998 murder of Bishop Juan Gerardi were nowhere to be seen. Two of them arrived 2 hours later under heavily armed guard, but a third officer, a retired colonel, said he was too ill to attend. The three-year murder investigation has been plagued by adversities, threats, and intimidation of judges and witnesses. It's the first time in Guatemalan legal history that high-ranking officers will stand trial for the murder of a civilian. Bishop Gerardi was allegedly killed for his history of denouncing the military's human rights abuses during the past civil war. The court said it would reconvene Friday morning. For NPR News, I'm Mike Lanchin in Guatemala City.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 98 points, or about 1%, to close at 9,389. Earlier in the day, the blue chip index was down nearly 4%. The Nasdaq gained 67 points. This is NPR. Police in El Cajon, California, have arrested a young man in a shooting today at a local high school. They say two people, including the suspected gunman, have been shot. At least seven others were hurt by broken glass or by falls in the confusion following the shooting. Authorities say the alleged gunman, an 18-year-old, was wounded in an exchange of fire with a police officer who'd been stationed at the school. The other person wounded by gunfire was 16. Law enforcement groups in Detroit are forming a task force to solve hundreds of open murder cases in the city. Quinn Kleinfelter reports from member station WDET in Detroit.
Nearly half of the 430 murders committed in Detroit last year remain unsolved. But a coalition of Detroit and state police, Wayne County officials, and the FBI hopes to clear those cases by this summer. Wayne County Prosecutor Mike Duggan says what's needed are new tactics.
The twist that we're going to put on it is this. There is the ability to bring people in and put them under oath under an investigative subpoena.
Duggan says those subpoenas are necessary because many of the unsolved homicides are drug-related, where witnesses often must be compelled to testify. But in recent days, Detroit police have been criticized for routinely arresting and detaining witnesses, sometimes for days. Federal statistics show that Detroit police arrested 3 persons for each murder committed in the city. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
The nation's biggest online stockbroker said today that it will cut its workforce by as much as 13%. San Francisco-based Charles Schwab Corporation said it will eliminate 3,400 jobs. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novosoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After covering George W. Bush's tenure as governor of Texas, journalist Ken Herman is now covering Bush's first 6 months in the White House. We invited Herman to talk with us about how President Bush compares with Governor Bush. Herman is reporting for the Austin American-Statesman and Cox newspapers. He's covered Texas politics since 1979. George W. Bush has talked a lot about bipartisanship. I asked Ken Herman what he thinks the president has been doing to act in a bipartisan way.
He always says there are other people up here who disagree with him, but he respects them. I was in the East Room for an event earlier this week with women business leaders, and he brought that up again, and he does all the time, that he knows everyone isn't going to agree with him. He has this line about it would be so much easier if he was a dictator and, you know, could just get what he wants done because he wants it done, but he knows that not to be the case. So he tries to tone down the rhetoric in public. You'll never hear him, I don't believe, say anything bitter about a Democrat. He will always say, you know, they're wrong, I disagree, but I respect them. He's really trying to change the tone on that. He also is, he believes some respect for the presidency has been lost around the country through activities of the previous administration. And it's very big for him to, in his mind, restore that. You've got to remember, presidency has now sort of become the family business for the Bushes, so they have some vested interest in it. And he's working at that. And it's interesting, I had a chance encounter with him, such that you can have a chance encounter with the president, last week on the South Lawn after event. And I was talking to him briefly about these many out-of-town trips he takes. This week he's in Florida at an event. He's going on the road, shopping his plan around. And he was telling me about how, you know, people, the American people seem to really enjoy the trappings of the presidency, seeing the flags, the limousines, and you could tell in his mind it was, he's glad that people see these things and are excited about it. So he is really working to, in his mind, tone down the rhetoric.
So you're saying that, you know, his public manner in Washington has been bipartisan, but his early actions have included policies or policy changes that have infuriated a lot of Democrats. For example, he reversed his position on regulating carbon dioxide, which is one of the gases believed to contribute to global warming. He undid the new Labor Department rule on ergonomics, which was aimed at preventing repetitive stress injuries like carpal tunnel syndrome. He imposed a new federal ban on federal aid to international family planning groups that counsel patients about abortion or promote abortion. How are actions like that being perceived in Washington in terms of his feelings about bipartisanship?
Well, they are perceived as what they are. They're somewhat contentious. Bipartisanship in the Bush view does not mean I will not do something I think should be done because someone on the other side doesn't want it done. That's not really his definition. His definition is we're going to disagree on some things, but let's try to do it in a civil manner. But I am the president. I am the first Republican president since Eisenhower to have control of both houses of Congress, albeit by the slimmest of margins in the Senate. And he does not seem willing or prone to give up any of that power in the name of bipartisanship. Clearly, in these early actions, and there are many more you could have listed on there, it's not taking us the traditional 100 days to sort of put a brand on this presidency. It is clear, what, 60 days into it, that President George W. Bush means business. And that means for him that the Bush family thinking of, in general terms, what's good for business is good for America. He is a businessman. He is the first president ever with a master's of business administration degree, and he seems to be mastering putting together a business administration here as we watch. and it'll be interesting to see how far it goes. Also this week, there was an EPA announcement of removing some arsenic-level standards in water. It's a business-friendly move, and it reflects his view that government, in general, is something that gets in the way of business. He often talks and has talked for years about government's limited role. Government is supposed to just create an atmosphere that encourages entrepreneurial spirit and sort of gets out of the way as much as possible to let people succeed and fail on their own as their talents, as luck, as the business cycles allow. The administration's take is that these are things that got in the way of business and unnecessarily so, and the final component would be there are other ways to accomplish whatever good these regulations did. So don't worry, we are not abandoning people to carpal tunnel syndrome. We are not making water dangerous. We are not hurting unions. Of course, it remains to be seen whether that's true.
President Bush is pushing for a $1.6 trillion tax cut that Democrats say largely benefits the wealthy. How is he working Congress behind the scenes now?
It's an ongoing effort. The in one way he's working Congress behind the scenes is by working in front of the scenes, by getting out around the country and encouraging people to email and write their members of Congress in favor of this tax cut. When you go out on the road with the president since he has taken office, it's very, very similar to campaign events. He is trying to build up heat out there for this tax cut, and it's an interesting process to watch. His belief is, if indeed a tax cut is proper, all Americans should get it. The unspoken second line is always, and that means wealthier people will get more back, a simple function of they pay more.
Is there any discord within the Bush administration on the tax cut or on any of the other policy changes or policy proposals?
No, they seem to be speaking with one voice. You never really know, of course. There could be some dissent. I was with an administration member last night, and we were talking about the daily senior staff meetings they have, I believe, at 7:15 in the mornings over there at the White House. And I said, you know, when everyone sits down, is it just kumbaya, you know, peace, love, and understanding, we all get along? And he kind of laughed, saying, no, of course not. But the difference is more on approach, on how do we, you know, what's the best way to sell some package? What are the best words to use? But they are aligned on message. It is a great strength of George W. Bush, of his ability to get from point A to point B in his mind and ignore all the noise on the side. He knows going into any short-range fight or long-range fight, it's just going to careen out of control, but he's just going to keep sort of moving forward and ignore it as best as he can. We saw it first in his 1994 race against Ann Richards, where he picked four issues he was going to run on, and he just talked about them until everyone was tired of hearing about him, at least those of us who traveled with him and heard it every day. But, you know, you also come to realize to penetrate the public consciousness on some of this, that's what it takes, a lot of time on task. And there was a lot of noise on the sidelines and dissonance and attempts or temptations to get him off message. Never happened, just kept moving straight ahead. And I think that's what we're seeing here now. We certainly saw it during the campaign that had, you know, it was rock and roll roller coaster ride that with a lot of twists and turns, even the Bush campaign never really anticipated. But on core message, they kind of just kept moving ahead. And I think that's what we're seeing, at least in these early days at the White House.
There was an article in the New York Times Monday of this week about how President Bush has the ear of the conservative think tanks and conservative coalitions. It quoted Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform and a leading conservative strategist, as saying, "There isn't an us and them with this administration. They is us. We is them." Is that your perception, too, that in spite of talk about bipartisanship, that he is very, very close with the conservative think tanks and coalitions and really has their ear and is working closely with them?
Well, there's probably no doubt they're philosophically aligned on most issues, so it's sort of a natural marriage. But it may not be that simple. It's just been an interesting dynamic to watch on the faith-based issues front. One of his signature efforts, and frankly more so than tax cuts or anything else, could make a lasting change in federal government, the relationship between church and state, and just very important facets of our democracy. Some of the top criticism has come from people on the right, people who supported him for president, people who supported the concept and now sort of have confused some people with the questions they've asked. People like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, a Bush advisor named Marvin Olasky from Austin, and they are, it seems like, now suddenly asking what appears to be a very basic question of, you know, fine, we can move forward with faith-based and decide that religious institutions who offer social services in a non-proselytizing way should be able to compete for federal funds. And now the first question is, how do we define what a religion is or who a religion is?
Yeah, specifically something that Pat Robertson said on the 700 Club was, you know, warning his listeners that it was possible that, you know, Scientologists and Hare Krishna people could get funding from the government if this goes through.
Yeah, and that's, I would imagine, a legitimate question of where is the cutoff between what's a religion, and what I think a religion may be a lot different than what you think is a religion, and that's where you get into long tradition in America of being very squeamish about the dangerous intersection of church and state.
President Bush's working style has been described as following a corporate model because he delegates so much responsibility. He's said to not like his briefing papers to run over a page or two at most. He's initiated a dress code for his staff, jackets and ties for men, business attire for women. He stresses punctuality. He's said to leave his office by about 6:30. It said he expects his staff to spend time with families in the evening and have time off on the weekends. Is the staff actually getting time off like the president is, or are they picking up the pieces when he goes home early?
I can tell you from talking with some just this week that, no, a lot of them are putting in very long hours, some especially on weekends. Days for the administration people start early because the president likes to start early, and then I think for a lot of the staffers, they go late because there's just a lot to do. But that is his style. He is the great delegator. He surrounds himself with people he trusts, who he believes understand where he wants to go, and he empowers them to move ahead. He likes things to run on time. He despises when cell phones or pagers go off during an event. There was an event this week where the cardinal sin was committed and someone did not turn off their cell phone. And it went off during an event with Prime Minister Sharon of Israel. And the president looked to the aide who was in charge of such things and said to that aide in a quite public way, "You apparently did not do your job well." And I'd be amazed if it ever happened again, because it was sincere consternation from the chief executive on something that for some reason means a lot to him. I think, it goes, in his mind, to rudeness and civility. You show up on time for events, you try to make them run on time, they end when they should end, and you don't have interruptions like cell phones or beepers when other people are sort of conducting business.
When you were covering George Bush in Texas, where he was governor, did you feel that with all of the delegating that he did, that he still really comprehended all of the policies being put into effect, and if he comprehended the issues in their full complexity?
Does anybody, I guess, is the obvious response. But yeah, a smaller stage again, education became his big issue, as he says it is his priority here. Very complicated topic. But in Texas, there was a feeling that he had a pretty good comprehension of education and where he wanted to go with it. And also maybe more so that he operates out of a basic set of philosophies that he thinks he can overlay on most topics and get from point A to point B, which always is his goal. And that he is not shy about sort of hiring the talent of sitting someone down on topic X and saying, here's the problem I see, here's where I'd like it to be, help me get there, as opposed to being someone saying, you know, I know how to get there. He's not shy about saying, about hiring the expertise and saying, here's my philosophy, someone work out the mechanics for me.
My guest is reporter Ken Herman of the Austin American-Statesman. After covering George W. Bush as governor, he's covering President Bush. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ken Herman, and he's covering the White House for the first 6 months of the Bush administration for the Austin American-Statesman and for Cox Newspapers. He's the former Capitol Bureau Chief in Austin for the Austin American-Statesman. He's covered state politics in Texas since 1979. One of President Bush's top issues is education. How would you say he left the schools in Texas? What were some of the policy or funding changes he was responsible for as governor?
The big thing he pushed for, one of the big things, was an end to social promotion. This business of you move from one grade to the other just because another birthday has passed and maybe you are not really achieving. And it's a stump speech line we heard ad infinitum, as we heard all stump speech lines, of the question shouldn't be how old are you, the question should be what do you know. And the only way we can tell what you know is testing. And he is an unending advocate of testing. We're still seeing how that'll work out. The social promotion portion of it really doesn't kick in, I forget the year, but we're probably a year or two away from it. And what we're facing there is the potential of the way the system works of having a widely administered statewide test that if children in grade school don't pass, they don't get promoted. And at the current rates, unless some education improves very quickly in sort of a very unexpected way, there may be many, many children for whom third grade becomes two or three very difficult years. And we'll see how the public reacts to that.
Do you get any special consideration from George W. Bush because you knew him as governor, you covered him as governor?
Let me say yes and no, which now makes me a politician, I guess. It's a very interesting hierarchy in Washington. Clearly, the major eastern newspapers who do this all the time, it's important to the administration, apparently, to keep them happy. Yes, I get some things, but in general, the pecking order works as it does regardless of who the president is. On the other hand, I do have good contact with people who worked for him in Austin for many years. It's some, indeed, who worked in Austin even before he got there and then became part of the Bush team. And they are still, you know, they will return the phone calls and they're cordial. But even in Austin, you have to remember about Bush people around him. They're very loyal people. This is not was not in Austin generally a group of great leaguers, and it hasn't been here. Now, when we start to really play the game here and it's more in their interest to be providing some information, we'll see how it works. On the other hand, there is some, when I get FaceTime with him, I've known him for a long time now. We have a cordial professional relationship. We've had our ups and downs over the years over things I've written. In his sort of peculiar way, he has a thick skin about it. He understands that he's not going to like everything that's written, and if he worries about it, he will indeed drive himself crazy. After an event recently in the Rose Garden when my family was in town, he had gone back into the Oval Office. Some of us had lingered in the Rose Garden, just reporters chatting among ourselves. Most of them left. He then came out and saw me there and had seen my son there and yelled over to me, "Hey, where's Jeremy?" Talking about my 14-year-old son. So I went in and got Jeremy, who was waiting in the press room, and my wife, who is also a reporter for the newspaper, Sharon, and you know, he chatted with us for about 15 minutes there. It was during that my 14-year-old son chose to lobby the president on Napster's behalf, I believe, fully an independent effort. And I can, my son found out quickly he was very unsuccessful in his lobbying efforts, as the president expressed very little sympathy for Napster's point of view. I tell my son after, I said, you know, 15 minutes of FaceTime with the president on an issue like that, you know, a lobbyist probably get, what, $1 million or so. I think my son went home to prepare an invoice to send to Napster, so we'll see how that turns out. But no, they are playing the Washington game up here, such that it is of the networks and the major newspapers up here are very important, and that's who they need to keep happy. On the other hand, one of the reasons they like to travel is, same thing during the campaign, it's a way of sort of bypassing the White House press corps and getting the message out directly. And twice so far since he's been in office, he's brought in regional reporters from newspapers around the country and had them for sort of a group interview session, 6, 7, 8 people at a time. There's been two of those so far with people from papers really pretty much around the country.
Is there much of a cloud over the White House because of the Florida fiasco and the knowledge that Gore won the popular vote and by one recount would have won Florida too and therefore the election?
The administration is moving forward as if it never happened. He is the president, and they dislike when you remind him of the unpleasantness because, again, it was a very trying time for the country and, you know, in a lot of people's minds has put a cloud over it, but they are ignoring it and just moving forward.
After Clinton's pardon list was released and Clinton was criticized by Democrats and Republicans for the people who he pardoned, what was the reaction inside the Bush White House? Was there any pleasure in watching Clinton be involved in another scandal?
I would surmise yes, they would say no. They went out of their way in extraordinary efforts to stay out of all of that. Even when there was word about the damage done to the White House by the outgoing administration, the Bush people wouldn't talk about it publicly because they just want to move forward. They want to set a new tone here. We don't want to blame anybody. And it was a very strange thing. Perhaps the first attempted cover-up in the Bush White House was of things that the previous administration might have done. But no, they went out of their way as if there had been a meeting where they all sat down and said, we are not going to take any public pleasure in any of this and just move forward. I think it was a clever strategy because it was sort of had a life of its own and they didn't need to be pushing it, and they certainly could look very magnanimous about staying out of it.
What have been some of the most difficult things for you in adjusting to covering Washington politics after covering state politics in Texas since 1979?
Incredible difference. In Texas, covering the legislature is a very hands-on, face-to-face experience. We have a citizen legislature made up of 181 members who are each paid $600 a month to do their job, and that's it. It's not supposed to be your full-time job. The legislature meets only for 6 months every other year. And you just wander onto the House floor and the Senate floor, and you chat with whoever you want to talk with. And some of them are fairly common people, as I guess a representative body is supposed to be. By the time people get to Washington, even the least sophisticated of them have some level of sophistication. The process does produce that. And it's frustrating. Lot of effort to get relatively little, and I'm used to, just from covering a state house, just walking up to the people I want to see and talking to them and generally getting an answer. Here you talk to an aide who talks to an advisor who gets back with you maybe, and it's cumbersome, frustrating, and it's like sometimes seems like journalism performed in molasses. And now some of it, again, is I'm new up here, learning the ways, learning the people, and I'm sure, though it's harder and harder to remember, when I first got to Austin, it probably seemed equally convoluted. And also just access. When he was governor, any governor of Texas, you could see whenever you wanted because the car was parked outside, and if nothing else, you waited by the car. And when the governor, be it Ann Richards, Bill Clements, Mark White, the many governors I covered, they sort of had to get in their car to go home at night, and you could always hijack them there and see if they'd answer a few questions. I still haven't found a place at the White House where I can wait and be guaranteed to see the president every day.
I'm not surprised to hear that.
I'm glad to hear it, I think.
Well, Ken Herman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
Ken Herman is covering the first 6 months of the Bush White House for the Austin American Statesman and Cox newspapers. He's covered Texas state politics since 1979. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the prison boom and its consequences. We talk with Wall Street Journal reporter Joseph Hallinan about his new book, Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. And Ken Tucker reviews Poisonville, the new CD by Ronnie Elliott.
Yeah.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Building and maintaining prisons has become a booming business. The first for-profit prison was built in 1983. Now there are more than 150 of them. But prisons aren't just profitable for the companies that run them. They can boost the local economy and offer a lucrative market to product manufacturers. Journalist Joseph Hallinan has written a new book about how the merger of punishment and profit is reshaping prison culture and the economy of prison towns. The book is called Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation, and it's based on his visits to prisons around the country. Hallinan is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's written about the criminal justice system for nearly a decade. I asked him how a prison can help the local economy.
It provides a number of tremendously stable jobs. If you open up a prison of, say, a prison that holds 500 inmates, you might employ perhaps, depends on the prison, 1,000 people, either directly or indirectly, as guards, as doctors, as nurses, as administrators. And then there's a spinoff effect. The prison, for instance, has to buy food from somewhere. So the local restaurant or the local food distributor, he gets the business. The prison has to be built, so the local contractor, he gets the business. The landscaping around the prison has to be maintained. If the inmates don't do that, then a landscape company has to do that. A prison just generates a tremendous number of jobs and injects tremendous amounts of money into the economy.
Has something changed that communities used to be afraid of having a prison in their area, and now a lot of places want a prison because it's good for business?
Something did change. People began to look at prisons not as this horrible place that might drive down the economy, drive down home values, but actually as a social good. They began to see it as, a place where they could punish inmates and that did society a larger good. And then very narrowly, they began to see it as a place that could do them good. You had, in the 1980s, a number of events happen. You had many heavy industry plants in the United States close because of competition by the Japanese. You had many military bases close. You had a number of other factors go on that sucked out many solid, good-paying jobs out of the small, remote communities in America. Suddenly, these people were desperate for jobs to keep their young people around, to keep their towns vibrant. They shopped around, and one of the few things they could find was prisons.
You visited a couple of prisons in Beeville, Texas, which is in South Texas. How have the prisons in Beeville affected the economy there? Beeville has a population of 13,000, and you say 7,200 of those people are inmates.
Right, correct. The people I talked to in Beeville actually seemed to prefer the prison to the naval base. They thought the jobs were much more stable. They thought that the prisons would not go anywhere the way the naval base did when a number of bases around the United States were closed. And the income spread all the way around the town. The guy who ran the local Mexican restaurant, he had much more business. He added on to his place. The former judge who owned the pawn shop thought his business had grown tremendously. The furniture shop in town, they said their business was good. Everybody was very happy with this. I had even teachers from the local schools who had quit their jobs and gone to work in the prison. They said the pay was better, the hours were shorter, and they said the stress was less, believe it or not.
The prisoners in Beeville have to work in the fields, in plantation-style jobs.
They do, very much so. I went to the Garza units one morning about 7 o'clock, shortly before dawn, and went behind the prison where the inmates are lined up. They're all wearing their white uniforms with green quilted jackets, and they line up two by two, and they're searched and inspected, and then carried out into the field on a trailer behind a tractor. Guards on a horseback trot next to them. The guards have either pistols shoved into their belts. There is one guard called a high rider who rides off from the other guards with a rifle, a 30-30, I believe. And his job is to shoot any inmates that escape. And the inmates are then unloaded into the field, given their tools. In this case, it was a tool called the Aggie, which is kind of a thresher, if you will, and they set out to work. And as they work, they sing. And the songs they sing are old slave songs, which is odd because not all the inmates are black. Many, of course, are white and Hispanic. And yet the songs they sing go back directly to plantation songs. And this has been documented by a number of musicologists who went to the Texas prison systems back in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, recorded the songs the inmates sang then as they worked, and they're almost virtually identical to the songs they sing now.
And is this considered constructive work? Is this considered punishment, reform?
I think maybe a few people thought there might be some reformative qualities in a day of hard labor, but I think primarily punishment. The work I saw really didn't need to be done. For instance, it was clearing ditches and cutting weeds, work which you can do with machines. You don't need to have 100 shackled inmates under armed guard out in the field to do that kind of work.
Let's look at an example of a high-tech prison that you visited. How about Pelican Bay Prison in Crescent City, California? This prison has 7 layers of security to prevent escape. Why don't you describe that security?
It's extremely elaborate, and much of it you can't really see. As with many prisons, in fact, if you look at them just to the naked eye, you can't really see a lot of the security that's involved. Only once you get inside the prison do you realize how really secure and, in Pelican Bay's case, really dangerous many of them are.
What do you see inside?
When I walked in Pelican Bay, for instance, I was walking around through one of the buildings with a number of guards, and I saw a large building which was initially designed to be a gymnasium, but because of overcrowding, they were turning it into bunk bed cell spaces. And I saw a large board on the wall that looks something like a blackboard, but kind of rubbery. And I noticed some smudges on it. I turned to one of the guards and I asked him, "What's with the board?" And he said, "That's a warning shot board." And I looked at him and I said, "A warning shot board? What do you mean?" He said, "That's where we fire warning shots. The board was actually made of rubber to absorb the bullets when fired inside. If the inmates in the cell block were to act up, the guards would open fire with live ammunition, first at the warning shot board, and then if the inmates didn't behave, they'd lower their guns and aim them at the inmates." And only then do you really get a feel for just how very, very dangerous a place like that is. And they've had a number of inmates killed there.
What are some of the other aspects of high-tech security at this prison?
If you go deep into the prison, the most secure place is a place known as a security housing unit, SHU, or SHU as it's pronounced. And you walk in there, and it's almost like walking into an intensive care ward at the hospital. I was recently in a hospital and sat at a nurse's station and watched as they monitored EKG devices and small little screens, and that is exactly what the guards do. They're completely encased in a booth, somewhat akin to an FAA control tower, if you can imagine that, with glass all the way around. And they have a number of screens that that are attached to cameras which monitor inmates in their cells so they can flip a switch and see who's doing what at any given time. The lights are down low. People speak in whispers. And all the cells are electronically controlled. You don't see anybody out in the hallways. You don't really detect much movement at all. Everything is structured so there's very little guard-inmate interaction. You don't have guards talking to inmates. The inmates are shackled virtually everywhere they go when they do leave the cells. And it's very white. It's very quiet. There's virtually no kind of stimulation at all. If you're inside the cell, it's blank walls. Outside the cell, it's blank walls. And that's the way many people spend years upon years of their lives.
What are supposed to be the advantages of the new high-tech prisons?
A couple. I guess the one that gets stated most often is that they're efficient. Many times these high-tech prisons allow prisons to watch a number of inmates with fewer guards. Five guards in an old prison, for instance, would be needed to watch inmates, whereas in some of the high-tech prisons, maybe only one is needed because of the use of cameras and other devices. But as I went to a number of these prisons, they seem to me to be intentionally punitive, and the people who run them acknowledge that with fewer guards around, they're able to deny inmates any type of interaction, and the inmates sit alone in their cells, and this is used as pressure to make the inmates conform.
Is there any way of knowing whether is there any way of knowing the psychological impact that these super maximum high-tech prisons have on the inmates?
I don't know of any quantitative studies, but a number of these prisons have produced lawsuits, and I talked to the people who are involved in them. And almost to a person, the psychiatrist who go in there described them as mentally debilitating. They would find inmates who smear themselves with their own feces, who cut themselves and drew or smeared blood on the walls, people who were babbling, people who were incoherent. And the prisons, interestingly enough, didn't really deny this. In fact, in TAMS, they were pretty open that they were about pushing an inmate to his breaking point, and that that was an intentional device that they would be using to change his behavior.
Do you get the impression that the super maximum prisons are more for the convenience of the guards than they are for the future of the prisoners?
You know, it's very interesting trying to figure out the purpose of the supermaxes. They vary from place to place. I went to Virginia where they were building a supermax at a place called Wallens Ridge, a mountain town that's way down in the very toe of the state, as many supermaxes are. They're almost always in very, very remote places. And I asked a number of people what the purpose of the prison was, what you're trying to accomplish here. And at first, they would tell me, well, this is for the worst of the worst, which is a phrase that gets used quite a bit. And you press them on that and say, well, who exactly is the worst of the worst? And you found over time that definition changed. And as it changed, it became more lenient and more lenient and more lenient. Do you had people in these supermax prisons who were serving relatively short terms, say 5 years, for nonviolent offenses. As criminals go, that's hardly among the worst of the worst. And as I talked to the folks, I began to think that the supermax served as some sort of proxy for society exacting its revenge on the inmates, that these were very, very tough places, and they were designed to be very tough. And the public felt good that these inmates were having a very rough time of it, that they weren't in prisons that were perceived to be very lenient places, places where inmates had the run of the place and could watch TV, order Playboy magazine, pump iron, do all these things that get a lot of taxpayers very upset.
So you can't do that stuff at the super maximum security prisons?
Generally, no. You are. Imagine yourself in a room about the size of a twin bed where you can touch both walls with your outstretched arms, where it's not much longer than you are tall, so that when you lie down on a bed, your feet very nearly touch the wall. And that's it. That's your home. That's your home for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. That is all you see of the world. No sky, no sun, nothing like that. It can drive you to the point of madness.
Joseph Hallinan is my guest. His new book is called Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. And this new book is about prisons, or the so-called prison industrial complex. Hallinan writes for The Wall Street Journal. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Oh, well, I believe I rode on down the line. Oh, well, I believe I rode on down the line. Oh, well, I believe I rode on down the line. It takes a number one driver down the line. Oh, well, Black Betty's in the bottom.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wall Street Journal reporter Joseph Hallinan. His new book about prisons in America is called Going Up the River, and he's traveled to many prisons around the country reporting on conditions there. How do for-profit prisons make their money?
It's funny, they make their money essentially just like hotels do. They build the prison, they figure out what it costs them per day to supply the room and board, the food, the guards, the maids in essence, everything you need just like a hotel. And then they charge the state $49, $59 a day, just as you would pay for a Holiday Inn or a Motel 6 or something like that. It's very, very similar.
One of the prisons that you visited that you write about in your new book, you describe as a model for the private prison in America. This is the Great Plains Correctional Facility in central Oklahoma. How would you describe this prison?
It was, of all the prisons I visited, I think the I don't know if I want to say the best overall, but certainly it's what you'd hope for in a prison, I think. If you were to take a tour, as I did, you would see computers inside where inmates can learn a variety of skills, or learn how to use Microsoft Word programs like that. There were musical instruments they could learn to play. The cells were clean and relatively spacious. The atmosphere inside the prison was not particularly hostile, as it is in many places, and the place seemed to run fairly well. And the town, which built the prison as a speculative investment, loved it, did quite well, sold the prison, and now took the money from that and is building a golf course and housing development.
So how come there are musical instruments and computers?
Largely to keep the inmates pacified. It's every warden will tell you, and this is the interesting thing about the debate that we've had over the last 5 years or so with the so-called get tough on crime mentality. You see a number of legislatures saying, take away the weights, take away the TVs, lock these inmates up, give them nothing to do all day because they deserve it because they did very bad things. It's true in many cases they did do very bad things. But what ask any warden, ask any guard, and what they will tell you is that makes their job 10 times tougher because a grown man who's locked away for 24 hours a day, who has no TV to watch, no weights to lift, nothing to do with his time, is an extremely dangerous person. And the atmosphere inside the prisons becomes extremely hostile and people get hurt.
One of the points you make in your book, Going Up the River, is that prisons mean money now in a lot of places. If a prison comes to a town, then more people will move there because there's more jobs, there'll be more restaurants opening, more supermarkets, gas stations, and so on. So, you know, prisons are connected with money. There's also companies that are making money by selling their products to prisons. One example is phone companies. I guess, you know, you used to not be able to make many phone calls as a prisoner, but now you say all prisons have this really big bank of pay phones.
It's amazing. The thing about a prison is it's essentially a small town, a city, and it needs everything a city does. So when you open a prison, you need doctors, you need nurses, you need a guy to fix the computer, you need somebody to haul the trash, you need all those things the city needs. And so every time a prison opens, all these people get hired. And of course, inmates, to a degree, need the same things that you or I need. They need toothpaste and deodorant and shampoo, and they need to make phone calls. And the phone companies in this country, AT&T, MCI, WorldCom, folks like that, were very quick to catch on to this. And in the early 90s, they began approaching the prisons with profit-splitting deals where they would come to the prison and say, hey, let us put in phones, and every time an inmate makes a collect call home, you get 50 cents of the dollar, we get 50 cents of the dollar. And this became extremely big business for these companies.
So did that change prison policy about how many phone calls an inmate could make?
Oh, absolutely. You would routinely in the 60s, 70s, and even in the 80s, see prison policies where the phone was used as reward. And if an inmate behaved, he might get 5 minutes a week on the phone or 5 minutes a month or maybe even only 5 minutes every 90 days. And the phone was used as a reward for that behavior. But as soon as there was profit to be made, the phone was no longer used as a reward. It changed, and inmates were allowed to use the phone basically anytime they could. Anytime they weren't working or weren't in school or in their cells, they're free to get on the phones and talk as long as they like because the prison was making money on it.
You visited prisons around the country. You've observed prisoners around the country. Do you worry a lot about what it will be like for these prisoners when they're released back into the world outside and what it will be like for the people who they're interacting with?
I do, particularly for the inmates who are confined in the so-called supermax prisons. In many cases, the inmates who are assigned to these prisons, as I said, will spend years in a solitary cell, literally not much bigger than a twin bed. And you will take an inmate like that, and in many cases, he will be released straight onto the street at the end of his term. He's not put in a medium security prison and then a minimum security prison and slowly worked toward freedom. One day he's in a cell 5x7, the next day he's out in the free world. And I don't know about you or anybody else, but the prospect of walking next to someone like that, sitting next to someone like that, passing someone like that on the street, I think is very frightening. Prospect just to release people like that. On the other hand, some prison systems, Iowa is one that's particularly noteworthy, I think, have tried to encourage inmates to get jobs while they're in prison with the for-profit sector, with real companies. And they do this under one condition, that the companies that employ them, if the employees do well, they offer them jobs when they get out. And they've had some success with that. I spoke with one woman who had been in prison for 16 months on a bad check charge, and she was 45 years old. And I asked her about this. She worked in a plant where they basically packaged dry powdered goods, something like Kool-Aid. And she made, I think, $7.50 to start. And she told me that she was so incredibly grateful for this job, because what it allowed her to do when she got out of prison was to have a big enough savings account. I think she had $1,800 that allowed her to put a deposit on an apartment and a down payment on a car and a real small amount of money in a checking account, and basically allowed her to get on with her life. If she hadn't had that in Iowa, she would have gotten, she would have received, I believe, $100 and a one-way bus ticket, and that would have been it. And that's precious little to start a life over again.
Joseph Hallinan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Joseph Hallinan is the author of Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Ronnie Elliott's new CD, Poisonville. This is Fresh Air. Ronnie Elliott has been making blues-influenced rock and roll since the 1960s, but he's never become a star. When rock critic Ken Tucker looked up Elliott's resume on the web, Elliott's biggest claim to fame seemed to be that he once had a band called Your Local Beer that opened for Jimi Hendrix in 1967. Nonetheless, Ken says Elliott's new CD, Poisonville, is the sort of album that defines an entire career.
He woke up in a blood-soaked bed, struggled through a mess in his mind, rubbed his eyes and staggered to his feet. He prayed that he wasn't gonna find the pretty dagger from the Times Square gyp joint sticking from a gash in her side. He knew in his heart the light was gone. He remembered what she said and he cried.
His voice is a little like Johnny Cash without the gravitas. His songs are a little like John Prine's without the whimsy. Actually, some of them would bring a smile to the face of rap star Eminem, like that song, Room 100, in which Ronnie wakes up hungover in a motel, hoping he won't find, quote, a dagger sticking from a gash in his girlfriend's thigh. But of course, he does. Elliott, born in Birmingham, Alabama, is the kind of guy who allies himself with people who go to extremes, who, in his words, burn, burn, burn. And he says this knowing that most of the time, the end result of such behavior is to become a burnout.
I only want to be with the ones who burn, burn, burn. Once in love with the night, they light up like a cigarette. I only want to be with the ones who burn, burn, burn. Ones with fire in their soul, little or nothing to forget. I want a romance and feeding the fire. I'm looking for poetry, searching for desire. I'm praying for God, begging for gin. I'm looking for goodness, living for sin.
Ronnie Elliott stops his CD dead in the middle to pull off his most audacious trick. He takes the year 1947, the year he was born, and makes the argument that this was the year rock and roll itself was born. Talk about foolhardiness, but listen and see if you don't get sucked into his version of history.
In 1947, Billboard still had race record in country and western charts. Hank Williams released his first record in January of that year. Alan Wolfe met Junior Parker in 1947. They decided to start a band. I was born in Birmingham, Alabama in that year. Same year that Winoni Harris signed a contract with King Records. And Roy Brown either wrote or stole Good Rockin' Tonight, depending on who you talk to. He released it as a record. And in Tupelo, Mississippi, a 12-year-old Elvis Aaron Presley started taking his guitar to school every day. Now the radio has gone to hell. Hank Williams has gone to heaven. They ask you when rock and roll was born. You tell them 1947.
Throughout this CD, Ronnie Elliott sprinkles literary allusions ranging from Jack Kerouac to Vladimir Nabokov, but for once, this is a singer-songwriter who earns his bookish ego, and at no point more so than in the title of his CD, Poisonville. As he points out in his liner notes, a phrase lifted from Dashiell Hammett, the original hard-boiled novelist who, like Elliott, worked a lot of different jobs and took a dim view of his fellow man while maintaining a healthy streak of romanticism. Commercial luck has always eluded Ronnie Elliott. My favorite fact that I learned reading about him on the internet is that in 1966, the band he was in at the time turned down a novelty song called Snoopy vs. the Red Baron that ended up selling millions for a less picky hack group called the Royal Guardsmen. Anyone who knows what a hunk of junk Snoopy vs. the Red Baron was will find Ronnie Elliott and Poisonville all the more invigorating.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Ronnie Elliott's new CD, Poisonville. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm living in a state of mind, having fallen from a state of grace. There's a long road behind me, a long road as far as I can see. My compass and my road map are the lines in my brow and my palm. The road that's straight is never the road that's free. I'm living in Poisonville. Got no love, I guess I never will. I keep running, I'm standing still. Right here in Poisonville. I had a fire that burned in me, and I let that fire go out. Walked around heaven, decided I could not stay.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Academy Awards ceremony is Sunday night. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Steven Soderbergh, who directed two films nominated for Best Picture, Aaron Brockovich and Traffic. And we'll talk about another Best Picture nominee, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, with the film's director, Ang Lee, and its star, Michelle Yeoh. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.